haven't they grown again? But at Matalan, that's no problem, because our £5 and under kidswear event has landed. Shop fresh new styles for kids and baby too, all for £5 or less. Shop online at matalan.co.uk and in-store now.
Welcome back to another episode of the 90th Percentile. This is your host, Jeff Ponce. Alongside me, as always, is my co-host, Matt Pajak. Matt, we're throwing a meatball right into your wheelhouse this week, man. We're evaluating top speed and MLB draft prospects. This is the essence of your being and existence over the last several years. So take it away, man. Let's talk about this. I'm interested to get into this with you because I think there's few people that sort of understand the process of evaluating athleticism, speed, but also the long-term impact. It's something that you've spent a great deal of time studying. So the floor is yours, Matt. How's it going, man?
I'm here.
Not your voice.
Yeah, Patrick Mahomes. Hold on. I got to get Patrick Mahomes off the mic. Nah, Jeff, this is like, I can feel like the electricity coursing through my veins right now. Like, this is like my thing right here. It was interesting. So let me open up. I was on a plane last night. I escaped Norfolk, Virginia, before that storm got up there. There were tornado warnings and whatnot, but got out of there. And I spent 3.5 hours on the plane listening to one of the latest episodes of Games with Names, with Julian Edelman. And I know that we're both fans of that podcast, being proud New England Patriots fans. He brought Ernie Adams back. And for anybody who doesn't know Ernie Adams, Google that one. That's Belichick's right-hand man for probably like 50 years at this point. Yeah, long time. Anyway, he's a little bit of like the guy in the shadows with the Patriots for a number of years who nobody really knew what he did, but he did a lot of things, right? So I love listening to Ernie talk. I love what Julian Edelman's got going there because it gives me behind the scenes into, you know, all the biggest games of my childhood. But Ernie Adams, there was a little segment before they got into the game. It was Chiefs AFC Championship 2018. But they talked about player evaluation and specifically, you know, some of the principles that Ernie Adams kind of held true to for a number of years, and talked about some of their favorite picks and, you know, Logan Mankins and Richard Seymour, and when they got Matt Light. I mean, anybody who's into player evaluation or, you know, football or anything in general, I mean, it's a must listen. So anyway, right around the 35-minute mark, I had to make sure that I bookmarked this. So this is where he talks about it. It's right around the 35-minute mark on a 3-hour podcast. Ernie Adams says something to the effect of, while he's talking about player evaluation, and Jeff, I almost did a backflip on the plane. He says, one thing that remains true always is you don't want to get away from size and speed. I was like, size and speed, size and athleticism, size and speed. It's a principle in football. It's a principle in baseball. It's a universal principle. So what we're talking about here, I'm not like some kind of like groundbreaking. Maybe it's a little bit groundbreaking to apply it in the baseball space. I know there's other people doing it, but I think the idea here is that this is a these are like timeless, boundless principles of athletic talent evaluation that apply not just to baseball, but they apply to other sports, but they absolutely apply to baseball. All right. And we're going to kind of break that whole thing down in here over the next 45 minutes, hour, however long this takes. But yes, this is, it's not like I unearthed the first ever dinosaur fossil, but I did unearth a dinosaur fossil. And a lot of you out there who are listening to this probably haven't unearthed that dinosaur fossil. But Jeff, to your point, I've spent the past 8 years immersed in this, 365 days out of the year, 7 days a week. I'm really good at it because this is my specialization. This is my study. Youth level, high school, college, pro. Sensitive periods for when this stuff can develop. How much of it's genetic? How much can performance-enhancing drugs impact some of this stuff? But ultimately, like, that's what I obsess over in this realm. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, if you're Jeff Ponce, there's a good chance that you're pretty passionate about baseball in some capacity. This is kind of my wheelhouse here. So, as you mentioned, but I want to get into it. Jeff, do me a favor, team me up, pull out the ham horn. You're going to be my Joe Budden for this podcast. No, I'm just kidding. Traditional ways of evaluating run on a scouting report for an amateur prospect.
60-yard dash if you're looking at amateur prospects at showcases, and then obviously home to first times in games, which could be at showcases, but I think, you know, historically is something you're going to see for a lot of college players and, you know, guys in their spring seasons. For high school, though, most of those players have probably already been covered pretty heavily, and they have run grades and run scores and, you know, traditional workouts, that sort of thing, might do 60-yard dashes, etc.
Yeah, so there's a player that, you know, I was high on for this entire draft cycle by the name of Cole Messina, drafted by the Colorado Rockies. And you've probably seen some comments on, you know, different write-ups, whatever. I've seen a couple on Baseball America where it's like surprising athleticism. And, you know, despite how he may appear, plus athlete, this is the stuff we're going to talk about, right? But I don't think Cole Messina had particularly good home to first times, Jeff. Remind me, you would probably know better than I would.
Yeah, I think they were like 40 home to first times, more or less consistently.
Right, but his top speed grade, per how I do my magic here, and I'll get into the Luden speed score in a bit, is plus, right? So there are a lot of things that go into home to first, right? Some guys are fast and just don't get out of the box well. Maybe it's because of the way their swing finishes. Maybe there's some guys that are halfway out of the box, like Ichiro, that gives them good home to first times. And then some guys don't accelerate really well, right? So there's some guys that have long legs, and maybe it takes them a little bit longer to get going. But once they get to top speed, if you give them long enough distance, they're going to catch somebody, okay? Now, I know you're like, well, that doesn't really happen in baseball. You don't have to run anybody down. We'll get into it. Let me talk. Okay.
Let them cook.
Let me cook over here. So some guys accelerate really well, which is a component of speed, but not the end all be all. Like, there's different segments of speed. There's acceleration, there's, you know, the transition phase, and then there's top speed. And then there are plenty of guys who don't have good home to first that are plus runners underway. Cole Messina kind of falls into that bucket. Cole Messina is a plus runner underway, if he wants to be a plus runner underway. And I'm going to talk about why that's important here after we talk about the 60-yard dash. I think Walker Martin was another one, Jeff. Walker Martin was another one that just had maybe average home to first times as a left-handed bat. But he's another one who had exceptional top-end speed in my evaluations of him.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of big-bodied guys in the Yankees organization, one who's one of the best hitters in baseball, and another one who's been on a burner lately, though he struggles with contact still. Spencer Jones is a guy that top speed is good. It's one of the reasons he can play center field. You see it when he's out there in the outfield chasing down balls. And Aaron Judge is another one where the home to first times aren't outrageous. But if you look at sprint speed, which obviously we have access to because of Hawkeye at the major league level, numbers are pretty good there too. So I think those are two really good examples of what you're talking about. Bigger guys, maybe a little bit slower out of the gates. You know, if you watch some of these, you know, sprinters, whether it's the 100, whether it's the 200 in the Olympics, obviously that's topical right now. You know, something that I think it was actually brought up about Usain Bolt when he was sort of coming up, where they thought he was maybe going to be a better, more distance runner, a guy that maybe run a 400, something like that, because he had that extra kick. Top speed was really good. He was bad out of the gates. And one of the things that allowed him to transition to the fastest man in the world, one of the all-time great sprinters of our lifetime, was the work on just getting out of the gates quick. And it is a skill. Like, if you've ever sprinted or ran some track in high school, if you've ever sprinted, like, that is definitely something that isn't natural, right? When you're coming from like a standing start and everyone's sort of going, it's a little bit easier. When you're coming out of those blocks, coming out of the gates, same thing. In baseball, it's even more magnified because certain swings, you know, the way that you swing the bat, the way your feet are in terms of, you know, how you rotate, you're not necessarily always going to be in a good running position. And I think that's often what hurts home to first times, is that second or so out of the blocks, where down the line, the guy's like, oh, he looks really fast. And then you're looking at a 4.6 runtime or something. And it's like, maybe there's more to this. So hopefully that sets you up a little bit, but I just wanted to give some background and some examples that I've seen personally, you know, at the highest levels at the Cape, and then just, you know, even a sport that's based around running, where
that's good, know, because the Olympics are relevant right now. And I watched the 100-meter final last week, and Noah Lyles was one of the slower guys out of the gates. If it was like a 20 or 30 meter sprint, which they don't do in the Olympics, but if that's what it was, I mean, he might have been the bottom of the entire list in that final. But you watched him make up ground from 30 to 70, and then ultimately he made the final push, and he won gold. And there's a lot of people that say the 200 meters is his event, which gives him more time to make up that ground, even though he got bronze in that event. And yeah, that's besides the point. But Noah Lyles, if you look at him as a track athlete, top end speed is there, and coming out of the gate was a little bit slower. But I think that's the whole point on the home to first, though, Jeff, is that there can be signal on home to first, and there has been signal on home to first. For like, if you're fast home to first, you're fast, you are, right? If you're slow home to first, maybe that's not an indicator that you're slow. So I think the point is that there could be a little bit of noise in that. Now, I understand traditionally there aren't a ton of good ways to measure speed, and speed's important, and that is kind of like a consistent measure for, you know, every player has to run home to first, every position player has to run home to first at some point, ground ball, whatever it is. So anyway, that's home to first, 60-yard dash. I'm not going to spend too much time on this. It's an endurance test. College athletes don't really run 60s at this point. I think there's a few that might run it at a workout. But if you're like a higher end power four college baseball player, the odds of you running a 60 in college are probably pretty low at this point, at least for a professional scout. I think a lot of these guys, and Jeff, you might be able to speak on this better than I can. My last couple of years, Cape Cod Baseball League, 2014, 2015, a lot of guys were starting to opt out of running the 60 at the Fenway workout day. I feel like that trend has probably continued.
I was not at the Fenway workout the last 2 years because it was a little bit earlier. I think one of them, I was someplace 2 years ago. It might've been around the time that I left for the All-Star break. So it's at a different point. And then it was a little bit earlier this year. And they haven't been as quick to sort of share, hey, this is when the Fenway workout is, come on down and watch it, you know?
Yeah, I think the point here is that if you look at like the big high school events, like PG National, East Coast Pro, Area Code Games, like those three events do a pretty good job of collecting the top high school talent in the country. Now, there's a couple of players that slip through the crack, but if you go to one of those events, you're going to be asked to run a 60, and you're going to do it. There's very few guys that don't do it. Either they're hurt or like there's some circumstance where they're not doing it, but like 99% of guys at those events are running – the 60, and 95% plus of the guys for the next draft class are at one of or multiple of those three events. So elite high school players run the 60 as part of their evaluation. Those opportunities don't really present themselves as much on the college side, and college players run it at high end college players. Less of them run it ahead of their draft cycle. So anyway, 60-yard dash is an endurance test. Just real quick, high school athletes are a mixed bag on who can endure, okay? So you've got the guys that are like, maybe they're a track athlete, maybe they're a football player, maybe they're a soccer player. They're consistently in the gym. They're strong. They're built. Maybe it's physical, early physical maturation, whatever it is. And these guys are they're built and they're trained to endure over 60 yards. So they're going to have a good time, right? But then you've got, sometimes you got guys who are fatigued because these guys are 17, 18 years old. And oftentimes, you know, if it's East Coast Pro, it's Alabama at the beginning of August. Right. So there could potentially be some fatigue, or there could be a lack of strength that they get to top speed And then they start tailing off at 30 yards. And for the next 30 yards, they're doing their best to try and maintain as much speed as possible, but it's trailing off, and then they don't have a good 60 yard time. Right. So that can muddy the eval a little bit. 60 yard times are muddy. It's, again, it's an endurance test. I don't think it's necessary. And I think it, you know, it plays into the strengths of the athletes. Like, and I'll go back to like 2017, 2018, Jerry and Ealy, running back and outfield prospect, ended up going to Ole Miss, played running back there. I think he's currently on the Chiefs practice squad, right? Really fast. Jerry and Ealy as a running back was prepared to endure for 60 yards. Whereas maybe Anthony Volpe, who was in that same class, I think it was the 2019 class, so it would have been 2018 East Coast Pro. Anthony Volpe was in that same class. Anthony Volpe was actually as fast as Jerry Neely getting to 30. And I think he was a little bit faster than Jerry Neely getting to 10, if I remember correctly. And then Jerry Neely ended up with a 60-yard time that was 0.2 seconds faster than Anthony Volpe, which is substantial, right? So anyway. That's the 60-yard dash, and we went over home to first. Those are the traditional ways that baseball athletes are graded on a scouting report, 20-80 scale, for their draft eval. And, again, there can be some signal in there, but there can also be some mud in there as well.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting because Ealy was, at least looking at perfect game rankings, was actually ranked – top 12 in that class, and Volpe was more like 25. One's a major leaguer, and the other one went to football, and, you know, he's a pro, but it hasn't been, you know, as successful as I think people would have expected.
Yeah, pursued a different dream. He pursued a different dream. So I do want to talk about evaluating top speed in the amateur space, because it's very doable, and a lot of people, I don't know if people are aware that it's very doable, but it's very important, and it's very important for a number of reasons. But the first thing that I want to call out is the load and speed score, which is what I developed. It's basically 0 to 12, but it mirrors a 20-80 scale. And it's, you know, a measure of top speed, not a measure of, you know, home to first or a measure of a 60-yard dash or anything like that. I'm specifically isolating top speed. Now, a baseball athlete is going to reach top speed. Now, you go look at the splits on a 100-meter sprinter. A 100-meter sprinter is not going to reach top speed probably until about 50, 60 meters in, right? But a baseball athlete, softball athlete, a lot of your team sport athletes are going to reach their top speed somewhere around 10 to 20 yards, right? That's where they get to top speed, and then at that point, there isn't a whole lot much more going up. Right, it's the nature of the game. Okay, why is top speed important? Okay, anyway, back to the load and speed score for a second. This is publicly available. Go to Load and Sports blog, LODEN Sports. You can find us on Twitter. You can find it on loadandsports.com under the blog. It's public. Speed kills. All of this research that I'm about to share with you, it's been public for months, if you wanted to go find it. So, but I found that the load and speed score is almost a perfect correlation to StatCast top speed on Savant. So if you go to Savant, you see the little slider that says top speed, and it says in feet per second what the player's top speed is, and it tells you the percentile. Load and speed score is almost a perfect correlation. So, yeah, I looked at almost 10 seasons worth of data on that. And correlation coefficient is 0.95. Anybody who's not familiar with correlation coefficient, -1, perfectly inverse correlation, 0, nor no correlation at all, 1, perfect correlation, 0.95, very close to a perfect correlation. So, yeah. Load and speed score correlated to top speed on StatCast on Savant. Now, I also found that in a sample of 28 high school players that I had a load and speed score on, I also had their MLB load and speed score. and the correlation coefficient was 0.65, which is really good. And then a sample of 27 college players that I had a load and speed score on that are now in Major League Baseball, correlation coefficient was 0.83, so even a little bit stronger because they've been in a strength and conditioning program for 2 to 3 years at that point, and they're pretty much maximized. So bottom line is if you're fast as an amateur, you're going to be fast 4 or 5 years later in the early stages of your MLB career.
And I don't think it's shocking that high school draft prospects could potentially slow down a little bit. Some of that obviously is adding on mass, focusing on maybe adding power. That period of like 18 to 23 years old is the period that power develops. We've seen that when we look at, you know, exit velocity numbers, and I've shared some of this with you, just looking at how it tracks throughout the minor leagues based on age, based on level. You typically see about 22, 23, there isn't the same jump that you see between 18 and 20, right? So guys adding on more mass, getting more power, becoming more impact hitters, they're probably going to slow down a little bit, especially in terms of how baseball players add mass versus what you would see maybe in a football player or a basketball player, where maybe just because of the type of training and the focus and the skills that you need to be successful, a little bit different.
100%. And Tristan Casas is a fantastic example of that, because as a high school player, his load and speed score was a 7, which
he ran pretty well in the minors too. Yeah. Saw it myself.
Yeah. It translates to a 55. And I mean, he's been a first baseman his entire professional career. And let's be honest, like, hey, how much time do we need to pull Tristan Casas to the side to work on sprinting if he's going to be a first baseman that bangs? All right, let's just add another 10 pounds and hit that ball another 15 feet further and we're going to be good. So I think his load and speed score last year was like a 4 or 5. So he's ticked down pretty much like a full standard deviation, maybe a standard deviation and a half there. But that's, to your point, what can kind of mess with, you know, why that correlation from high school to MLB is a little bit different. So anyway, why is this even important? Why is the top speed on StatCast on Savant, why is that important? Why should I be looking at that? Why is the load and speed score important when you're evaluating amateur prospects? Why is top speed important? This is not about getting home to first. This is not about, you know, winning a 100-meter sprint. This is about, again, and this is all in that blog, Speed Kills. There's a correlation to elite defense in the outfield. All right, you look at some of these defenders that we have in the game that are fantastic. You look at like Pete Crow Armstrong is a really good young defender. Brent Doyle as a rookie, unheralded, right? Fourth round Division II player, Gold Glove as a rookie, right? Kevin Kiermaier for a number of years. I mean, you think about some of these guys that are patrolling center field in the big leagues and doing it at an elite level. They're burners. They are really, really fast. I mean, you think about like a guy that was really good in college that's currently making his way through the minor leagues, Enrique Bradfield. He provides that value in center field. He's a burner. He covers a lot of ground. These are the kinds of guys that can cover three oceans. But there is a real correlation, and again, that's in that blog, to elite defense in the outfield, in center field, to top speed, which makes sense. Range. Think about that play that that Zidane Rafael made. Let's talk about that for a second. Okay. Rafael makes this play. What was it, in Kansas City?
Yeah.
Where he's going back on this ball, and it's almost like he caught it like backhanded, and I don't even know if he was looking when he caught it. Right. But people are like, oh, this is an insane catch. This is one of the most ridiculous catches you'll ever see. And I agree. It was something that, like, I don't know how he caught that ball.
There was some debate on that, Matt. I don't know if you realize that.
That's what I'm coming in with. Okay. And then here comes the StatCast crew, Mike Petriello, and there are a couple other people, and they're like, guys, I hate to break it to you, but the catch probability on that was 99%. And it's like, okay, I get that. But he didn't get a good jump on it.
Yeah.
Bad route. I don't want to talk about the catch probability because he didn't get a good jump on it. So from the point that he actually started tracking that baseball, let's start there and let's not start with the jump. What's the catch probability from there? Because it's probably really low, and it's probably something that most guys don't have a chance to make a play on that ball. recovery speed, essentially. It's like when a corner gets beat and then has time to make up ground and then still make a play on the ball. That's what Rafaela did there. Okay. So it is still a phenomenal catch. I don't want to sit here and be like 99% catch probability. That's not that impressive. He got a bad jump. He got a bad read on it. But only top end athletes with top end speed can make up and still make that play. And that's the point. All right. So correlation to elite defense in the outfield, correlation to stolen bases. There is a correlation to stolen bases. Now, you know, there are plenty of guys that have really good top end speed that don't steal bags because they don't get, you know, good reads. And it is a skill to steal bases. You don't just have to be really fast. I think that's something that maybe people don't appreciate with Ellie De La Cruz, with how many bags he's taking, is that like, it's still a skill. He's still getting reads and he still has instincts on the base paths, and he's doing some phenomenal things. Like I saw the other night, I think Max Meyer might've been on the mound, if I'm remembering correctly. Like, he was on second base. He kind of saw the third baseman sleeping. He's like, I can beat the third baseman to the bag. And then he stole third base, you know, without even a pitch to the plate. There's instincts there. He's not just the fastest man alive. He's the fastest man alive with instincts. But then there's guys that maybe are above average runners that have really good instincts that also steal bags as well. So there's a little bit of a sliding scale. But there is a correlation that I did find between top speed and stolen bases. Okay. This next one I want to talk about is the force velocity curve. And before I get into the force velocity curve, Jeff, I want to take a pause here so that we can
actually do a break.
Yeah,
for the first time, like 6 weeks. So, all right, before we get into that, let's take a quick break. Word from our sponsors. We'll be right back, Matt.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging. You can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. I think we're going to have an opening coming open. When it comes open, I'm going to use Indeed. Why? Because Indeed makes my job easy. When I'm hiring, it puts it all in one place. It organizes it. It does the thinking for me to where I can just connect with quality candidates and do the process that we need to do to hire. That's what Indeed does. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. The heat of summer is here. Whether you're going for a long run or just sitting by the pool, your favorite summer treat could be giving you extraordinary hydration. Liquid IV has refreshing summer flavors like Popsicle Firecracker and Rainbow Sherbet that hit the spot when you need transformative, hydrating relief all summer long. Indulge in hydration with electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients from the number one powdered hydration brand in America, Liquid IV. Did you know that blue and pink cotton candy are different flavors? I didn't until I started enjoying both of them through Liquid IV. Personally, I'm partial to the blue cotton candy. I make sure I pour some in my water bottle with some ice before I head out on a bike ride. It not only hydrates, but it's a more enjoyable way to stay hydrated. Blue cotton candy, that's my recommendation. But I've yet to find a Liquid IV flavor I don't like. Cool off your summer with the reimagined flavors of treats like Rainbow Sherbet and Popsicle Firecracker. Or make your own Liquid IV popsicles. Indulgent flavors keep your wellness rituals fresh and keep you motivated and hydrated. Find all your favorite flavors on the website. There's acai berry, lemon lime, pina colada. You can even choose from their line of sugar-free flavors like raspberry melon, white peach, and green grape. The white peach, that's pretty good too. Tear, pour, live more. One stick and 16 ounces of water hydrates better than water alone. It's powdered by Live Hydroscience, an optimized ratio of electrolytes, essential vitamins, and clinically tested nutrients that turn ordinary water into extraordinary hydration. 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, 8 essential vitamins and nutrients. Always non-GMO, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free, and soy-free. Indulge in hydration this summer with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
Haven't they grown? Again. But at Matalan, that's no problem because our £5 and under kidswear event has landed. Shop fresh new styles for kids and baby too, all for £5 or less. Shop online at matalan.co.uk and in-store now.
All right, and we are back. Matt, all right, we've been jumping into some of the different components of evaluating speed, MLB draft prospects. Talked about evaluating speed just at a base level. Talked a little bit about the loading scores. Talked about the 60-yard dash and home to first times. Talked about the correlation of the loading scores to speed and how it's kind of broken down. And then we got into a really good discussion about top speed and its benefits. Let's go on to the next component of this one here. I'm going to serve it over to you. Start it up. Let's get back into this discussion. We got a lot to talk about still.
It's not lost on me that we were in lockstep on that break. I had like a note in my head and I was like, okay, time for a break. And you literally started making like the break. Yeah. You broke the dang bat over your leg at the same time I was getting ready.
Head. Yeah. Bo Jackson style over my head.
Yeah. You broke it over your head. Okay. So we talked about top speed specifically, the importance of evaluating top speed and how it correlates to elite defense in the outfield, which it does. How it correlates to stolen bases, which it does. Those are two of the more obvious applications. But let's talk about the x-axis of a force velocity curve. All right. So this may be new to people listening to this, but there's this thing called the force velocity curve. You can Google it, and it's a very well-known principle in strength and conditioning. The x-axis, if anybody's ever been in a math class, the x-axis on the graph is speed and or velocity, and the y-axis is force, which we can roughly assimilate to strength, right? So strength, speed, strength, speed. What's the intersection of strength and speed, Jeff?
Force.
Power.
Power. Hey, there we go.
Power.
I'm not very smart.
Okay. So strength, Jeff, think about it. You or I could go get on like a strongman program, and we could go get in the gym and we could go get really strong. We could do it. That's something that kind of like almost all human beings can do, right? We can take the right supplements, the right legal supplements or illegal supplements. You know, we've discussed it. You know, there's probably certain players out there still that when you think about this conversation have boosted their force profile, probably not the most kosher ways. Besides the point, you or I could go get strong in a very legal way with good supplements, a good training routine, and we could get jacked. It's kind of like this thing that all human beings can do. And it's why when players show up to campus and they get into a strength and conditioning program, they all get strong, right? But speed is largely genetic, and your opportunity to impact your speed potential really happens before you hit puberty. So if you don't have a parent that's on top of this, or you're not playing the right sports that are getting you to top speed frequently before you hit puberty, call it 12, 13, 14 years old for a male athlete, like, look, you are what you are kind of at that point when you hit your growth spurt, right? And a lot of it is largely dependent on when you go look at your parents. So I ask your parents, hey, when you're running around on the playground or you're playing your sports in high school, college, whatever it was, could you run? You know, what kind of runner were you? That's largely what sets your ceiling for your x-axis, right? So if your y-axis is strength and your x-axis is speed, the y-axis is improvable for pretty much everyone to a point where there's diminishing returns where it's like, okay, you don't need to get any stronger. You're strong enough, right? on the x-axis, you can try and get faster. You can try and increase your top speed. It's not going to happen for many guys. We talked about that before in terms of the correlation, you know, between amateur load and speed scores and then what we're seeing at the big league level in the same players, right? If you're fast in high school, there's a good chance you're going to be fast in the big leagues. If you're fast in college, there's a good chance you're going to be fast in the big leagues. If you're not fast in high school or you're not fast in college, there's a good chance you're not going to be fast in the big leagues. And it doesn't matter if you go work with one of the top speed coaches in the world. You might be able to improve that a little bit. Most of these guys aren't doing that. You're probably going to be roughly the same runner at 18, 19, 20 years old as you're going to be when you're at peak athletic performance, 23 to 27 window. Okay. So with this in mind, the intersection, if you look at this force velocity curve, between, if you draw a line between where you're at on the velocity x-axis and where you're at on the force y-axis, that's your force velocity curve, and that's basically, you know, how much power you're generating. So as your strength increases, that line gets further away from coordinate 0, 0, which is like the beginning point. As speed increases, it also does the same thing. So naturally, players who start with more speed, because it's not something that's very easily improvable, as they add strength, they've got a chance to have a line that is further away from coordinate 0, 0 than a player who has average speed or below average speed, because they're not going to be able to improve that quality on the x-axis. So if you're following along at home and you're listening to this, I know I threw a whole lot at you. I promise you, like, if you're interested in this, there are plenty of resources on the internet. Go Google it. But basically, speed sets the bar for how much raw athleticism you could potentially have at any given point. Okay. Because again, we can all add strength, we can't all add speed. All right. So players that start with more speed have a much better chance of realizing more power. Now, what I found is that power translates on a baseball field into throwing velocity and exit velocity, right? So you look at a guy like Garrett Crochet, who's sitting 97, 98. You know, when he came up as a reliever, he was 102, and it is effortless. That's because you're talking about a really big athlete with mass and a ton of strength on top of the fact that he runs like a gazelle. And a lot of people don't know that because he's a left-handed pitcher and all he's ever done is pitched. But he can thank his parents. Fantastic genetics there. Okay. I would not want Garrett Crochet running me down in an alley if I happened to steal his purse.
You might have just set him off there by saying he carries a purse. It's a satchel.
It's like what all the kids are wearing these days down in like Miami is they've got like these little backpacks that they wear across their chest and it's in the front. I remember Irv Carter with the Toronto Blue Jays rocking the Louis Vuitton to the Dream Series. Anyway, yes, intersection, speed, strength, boom. Top speed is important. That's ultimately the gist of this whole thing. The last kind of component of this that I want to talk about is that top speed atrophies as players age. And there are implications here for longevity, right? So this is kind of like the last reason why top speed is important is that as players age, especially, and we talked about how, Jeff, what's that peak window for athletic performance, regardless of age? 23 to 27.
I was going to say 22 to 28, but yeah, okay. You're right.
22 to 28. You're right in the window. Okay. There's a reason why you turn on the Olympics and you don't have a bunch of 30-year-olds running the 100-meter sprint.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a reason why that these guys break down and they start crying when they're 25 years old and they miss the podium, because they know 4 years from now, they're going to be 29 and they're going to be out of that window. You know, it's kind of similar to like gymnastics in a different respect where it's like, okay, if you don't get it when you're 17 or 18 years old, like it's not going to happen for you when you're 25. There's a short window where you're at peak and there's just nothing you can do about it. It's like you can work harder than the 23-year-old that's got uber genetics. At 28 or 29, there's a really good chance you're just not going to beat them. And it's just natural human physical development, right? But I want to talk about how speed atrophies as players age. We know based on the force velocity conversation that if your speed atrophies, then that line gets closer to 0-0. Your power goes down. And if your power goes down, then your exit velocity probably goes down and your throwing velocity probably goes down, and then you become a more skill dependent player. And that's why you don't see a bunch of 35 plus year olds playing in the big leagues, because they're a player. Like it's a very fast paced game. That's very dependent on impact and speed and these types of things. Right. So, but there are players who can slow that atrophy and can beat the average by being deliberate about it and how they train. And I think specifically we're going cross sport to Cristiano Ronaldo, who's in his late 30s and he's still one of the fastest players in soccer. And he can do that because he specifically focuses on speed training and holding on to that speed. Now he's probably working a whole lot harder for his speed in his late 30s than he did in his early 30s. And then even more so than in his 20s, where it was probably effortless, right? But it's important to him, and whoever is behind his team, whether they're it's deliberate or not, understands that his longevity for his performance, being a top soccer player in the world, being able to do what he does, depends on him maintaining as much of that speed as possible, preventing that atrophy so that that force velocity curve line stays as far away from 0-0 as possible, keeps his power up. And that, yes, it does translate in soccer too. And it translates in football, and it translates in basketball, and it translates in pretty much every team sport, going back to the whole universal principles thing. Force velocity curve is not one sport dependent. It's all sport dependent. All right. Power is damn near gold. Anyway. So think of like a Cristiano Ronaldo, late 30s. He's proof. Zlatan Ibrahimovic. I think you see a lot of examples in soccer because these guys running is a large part of the game. But they hold on to their speed for longer. And when they hold on to their speed for longer, it increases their longevity for performing at a high level on the world stage. And ultimately that's really important. But when you think about baseball, top speed isn't like as prominent in your face as when you're watching a soccer match, right? So when you think of some of these aging superstars who have already been paid big money, it's like it might not be so obvious to them that they could elongate their career and they could elongate their performance on field by slowing the rate of atrophy on speed. And I think of like a guy like Paul Goldschmidt. I think has done a pretty good job, if you look over the years, of maintaining his speed as he's aged. He's almost 37 years old now. And then I think of certain guys like on that same team, Nolan Arenado. I think Alex Bregman's probably another one. They've had great careers, but neither are elite runners. And Arenado isn't aging gracefully, and Bregman is only a couple of years behind him too. Right? Like Arenado's 33 years old, and you've seen the frustration visibly on field for the past 2 years. And you can go look at his Savant sprint speed, and he's in like the 15th percentile for sprint speed. And the other factor that kind of comes into this, which we're about to translate or we're about to transition into here, is size. Going back to Ernie Adams, size and athleticism, size and speed. And that's kind of like my whole thing, is that size and athleticism equal physical tools. All right. The more size you have, the less raw athleticism you need to reach the same physical tools as a guy who is smaller. So I think like plus size athlete can be a below average athlete. Plus size frame, below average athlete, roughly equals average size frame. Average athlete roughly equals small frame plus athlete in terms of the physical tool output. Right? Sliding scale, size, athleticism. Okay, so size does not atrophy, Jeff. And I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Size doesn't atrophy, athleticism does. I think this is why we don't see a ton of small pitchers in the big leagues. I think this is why you see a lot of big leaguers that are playing into their mid to late 30s are larger, right? I want to specifically say, okay, there are guys that I know have really impacted clubs in their mid to late 30s. David Ortiz, example. Albert Pujols was still getting to power, example. Nelson Cruz, 40 home run seasons, example. And then you think of some of these pitchers. I think like I look at like the juxtaposition of like, use the Cardinals again here. Lance Lynn, like 6'5", 280 pounds, doesn't atrophy. But for Sonny Gray, who's 5'10", 190, okay, as he ages and his athleticism atrophies, the velocity is going to drop probably a little bit more than Lance Lynn. And he's going to have to rely on spin, hitting his spots, and being a crafty pitcher to kind of continue. So I think that's another thing. Like Marcus Stroman's another one. Like earlier in his career, you probably saw more velocity. He's kind of, I think at this point, Jeff, he's what, on the other side of 30, 32, 33, something like that. He's years out of his athletic prime. And I think he pitches mostly at what, like 90, 92 at this point?
Yeah. I think that's where he's at. I can look it up specifically, but from what I remember, I think that's about right.
Yeah.
Not so he's a huge speed merchant before, but.
Right. But he might have grabbed the 4 or 5, 6, 7.
Yeah, 89.7 this year on the fastball.
Yeah. Right. And at one point he was pitching at 92, and at one point he was grabbing a 94 or 95. And I think that's kind of the point. It's like Sonny Gray was throwing harder a couple of years ago, and now he's 90, 92, touch a 93. And then in the next year or two, I would bet that would continue to scale back. So he needs to continue to make sure that he can hit his spots, spin it, and go out there and compete. Because that's kind of the recipe for a smaller pitcher as they age. Whereas you look at like a Lance Lynn, and Lance Lynn still goes out there every fifth day. And despite how he looks, his size does not atrophy, and he's still able to grab a 94, and he's still pitching at 93, even though he's in his mid 30s and he's not, you know, a model athlete. I think, Jeff, this is why in there are so many traditional scouting thoughts where it's like, oh man, like, you know, we want a pitcher who's 6'3, 200 pounds, 220 pounds. You know, we want a big body because like we know that's going to hold up. Look, there's science behind this. Right? Long levers and size don't atrophy. So there's longevity attached to it. So if you're going to evaluate and go after a younger pitcher or a smaller pitcher, you just have to kind of understand that, like, okay, as he gets close to 30, like this is probably what's going to happen. And it's the same thing on the position player side. And it's what you're seeing with Arenado. And it's why, you know, I wouldn't be overly bullish on Alex Bregman. And it's just because like these guys don't have a ton of athleticism left and they don't have size. So like the physical tools are probably going to fall off pretty quick. Their value is going to be like, think of what Brandon Crawford has accomplished in his career as he's aged into his mid to late 30s. It's like, well, Brandon Crawford can still hit enough and he can still play a high level shortstop because he's so skilled. That's what you're going to need to do to continue to provide value to a big league club. And I think both Bregman and Arenado can do that. They just kind of have to accept that, like, okay, you're not going to hit 30, 35 home runs anymore.
Yeah, I mean, Arenado is still a standout defender at third. He's still a great defender at third, but that's where he derives most of his value from. And it's funny, kind of digging into the numbers here as you were talking, there's been a significant drop-off in exit velocities, which kind of ties into an earlier conversation on this podcast. I mean, it's been a 3 mile per hour drop on his average year over year. His max exit velocity tracks almost exactly with that. It's been 2.8 miles per hour. He had a 110.3 last year. His max this year is 107.5. And I could probably find a few hundred players with a higher max just in the minor leagues, some who are teenagers. And, you know, in his peak years, it was all like, you know, 109s to 111s. You know, not crazy bat speed, but he always, you know, paired power with skills. He's still got the skills. His zone contact rate's still 90%. He's still not striking out a lot. He's never been a huge walk guy, a little bit more of an aggressive player, but that hasn't translated as well offensively now that the power is gone, because he's aggressive to put the ball in play and he's turned into more of a singles hitter than the power guy that we saw for, you know, the better part of a decade between Colorado and early with St. Louis, where, you know, he didn't have a season outside of 2020, which obviously was only 48 games for him, where he had less than 26 home runs. And even last year, that was a pretty stark departure from, you know, what he was doing in Colorado. Obviously, there's some aid there as well, but 42 in 2015, 41 in 2016, 37 in 2017, 38 in 2018, 41 in 2019, then gets traded to the Cardinals in 21, 34, 30, 26. He's got 11 home runs through 109 games this year. So for him, he'd have to go on a burner the last 5-6 weeks of the season here in order to get to 20 home runs. And it's probably unlikely that he even gets to 16 or 17. So I think that kind of shows exactly, Chris, like crystal clear, how that can atrophy and how it can impact not just running and defensive ability, but that power.
Yeah. And gosh, I wish he could listen to this podcast and not see this as like, you know, go F yourself, Matt Pajak. But I almost wish I could get through to him that, like, okay, look, like, based on all of the what I've laid out here objectively, science, size, athleticism, translating to tools, like, you may have to adjust your approach at the plate and be a different type of hitter. Like, you're not going to be able to just pull balls over the left field fence, because he's had historically a very strong pull side profile on his fly balls, right? And I don't think there's a world where he's under a big contract right now where he magically goes to Houston and he gets to benefit from the Crawford box or whatever it is.
Yep.
But like, that's the kind of place he needs to go. That's the kind of place that Alex Bregman needs to stay. Because if Alex Bregman was in St. Louis, Alex Bregman's not putting balls out of St. Louis. St. Louis is a traditionally pitcher's ballpark. Balls don't fly out there. And that's a lot further to have to hit a ball to hit it out pull side for a right-handed hitter. But yeah, that's kind of like the gist of this: size and athleticism. Size doesn't atrophy, athleticism does. And for guys who are not 6'4", 220 pounds, that want to play this game for a long time, or that want to play into their mid to late 30s, there's like a certain level of like, do you need to take a Cristiano Ronaldo approach to it and try and preserve your athleticism as long as possible? Yes, that's important. But also, do you, if you're past the point of no return, like an Arenado is, where it's like you've already lost whatever speed you ever had and you're probably not getting it back at 32, 33 years old, you need to shift your approach and be a different player. And yes, you can go out and be productive in a different way, especially, Jeff, because you said he's still an 80 defender at third base. He still absolutely is every bit of that. He makes plays every week that show that. It's just, you know, it's like everybody struggles with getting old, right? That's like a human condition. Like, this is it applied on a baseball field. So back to the atrophy thing. What can accelerate the atrophy? Injuries and poor or incomplete rehab early in your career could potentially accelerate that atrophy. So think, if you're like 25, 26 years old, you get a hamstring injury, maybe you didn't rehab it right. It really, Jeff, I think it crushed Troy Tulowitzki's career. I can't remember what the specific injury was, but towards the back end of his career, he was trying to come back. He got hurt, and then he was starting to ramp up, and then he re-aggravated it. I think it put him in the ground, right? But if you don't have the speed component, then, you know, you're relying strictly on strength, the strength side of that force velocity curve. And if you're a player that's not 6'4", 220 pounds, like a Nelson Cruz or an Albert Pujols or a David Ortiz, that's got a lot of mass, like, it's not going to be there for you if you're competing against a 23 or 24 year old top prospect who's tooled up. Like, it's not. So anyway, let's see, what else do I have here? I think of it, Jeff, a little bit like anybody who plays video games. Like, I used to play a ton of FIFA, and like, you see it in NBA 2K, but you're playing a game and like, you can hit the sprint button, you can hold the sprint button, and then like, over the course of the game, like, a player fatigues and that juice bar doesn't get as high. That's a little bit of how I look at speed over the course of an MLB career. It's like, okay, how do you maintain, how do you keep that bar as full as possible for as many years as possible? Because, you know, for some players, it's like you get to the late in the second half of a FIFA game and it's like you got your 35-year-old center back who you've had a couple good sprints with, and it's like, man, if you try and sprint with him, like, you might get a second before you're out of sprint with him, right? More or less, that's the metaphor there. But just kind of go back to this, like, you know, 27, 28 being kind of like the end of that peak window. You know, let's talk about fantasy baseball here for a second. I mean, we had the conversation back in January or February, Randy Rosarena, right? And it's like, well, Randy Rosarena, average big league runner, you know, 20 home runs last year. He does try and steal bases, but he gets caught. He's only successful at like a 60 to 66% clip. And I think that's been consistent again this year. But he's kind of at that point where it's like, okay, his physical tools are going to start falling off. He's never been an elite defender. He's not a center field defender. And like, yeah, he's from a fantasy purpose, we're chasing stolen bases and home runs. And so he's only getting the stolen bases because he's ultra aggressive on the base paths. And like, he does get thrown out. I was like, if you're trying to trade for that guy, like, why don't you go trade for another corner outfielder who's also 28 years old, who the Cleveland Guardians just traded for at the deadline from the Washington Nationals, Lane Thomas. You go look at his speed on Savant. I think he's closer to like the 90th percentile as opposed to the 50th percentile. And when you're applying what I'm talking about here, where speed's atrophying and your tools are potentially atrophying as your speed atrophies, like, Lane Thomas is probably going to age better in terms of still being able to provide more production on field over the next 3 or 4 years than Randy Rosarena. They're roughly the same age. They play the same position. And to this point, have roughly given you the same production. Right. So there's your application if you're a fantasy baseball head and you're following me and Jeff to try and get a tip there, get ahead of all the people in your league. But, let's apply it to real life real quick, and then we'll get the people out of here. If you are this is a disclaimer straight out the chute. If you're a hit tool is the only tool kind of guy, cover your damn ears. Cover your ears. Yes, the hit tool is important, and I think it's possible to like different types of players and to like different types of profiles on players. And I think that's the beauty of the game. And that's the beauty of evaluation, is that we don't all have to like the same players. We don't all have to have the same philosophies, right? But yes, the hit tool is important. I'm not saying that it's not, but I've got important things for you too: size and athleticism. Okay, so if you are a hit tool is the only tool person, and you can open up your ears, you can open up your mind for 5 to 10 minutes, I think this is going to be really useful for you, because it's why guys like Bobby Witt Jr., Jaron Duran, and Brent Doyle are more impactful stars than guys like Louis Arias, Stephen Kwan, Jose Miranda. Okay, because the hit tool is the only tool crowd would love Louis Arias, would love Stephen Kwan, and would love Jose Miranda. And to be fair, Jeff, I really like those players too, because
good players.
I like guys who can hit. I'm a baseball fan. I grew up a baseball fan. I like seeing guys be able to go in the box and not swing and miss, control the strike zone, take a walk, barrel baseballs, base knock to left field, base knock to right. I love it. I love it. Right. But I also love Bobby Witt Jr., Jaron Duran, and Brent Doyle. And I probably love them more. You know, it's, and the reason why is because size and athleticism and ability to hit is translating to much bigger impact and elite defense. And you're talking about the best players in the game right now, because they're five tool players performing like five tool players, and per every advanced metric, they're top 10 players in the game, right? And they've got size, and they've got athleticism, and they've got ability to hit. That's ultimately what we're talking about. I was like, check those three boxes, and like, boom, bingo, stars, billboards. Every fan in the stands is buying their shirts. That's what we're looking for. That's what we want, right? And I think the peak outcome for like the average athlete with average size who's got amazing bat to ball skills is Stephen Kwan, Louis Arias, Jose Miranda. Most people don't even know who Jose Miranda is. He's hitting 320 in the big leagues right now in almost a full season. And oh, by the way, I got a notification this morning on my phone from my fantasy team that Jose Miranda is kind of in no man's land because Royce Lewis is back again and he's going to play third base. And Matt Wallner has emerged in the past 2 weeks and he's probably going to start being the primary DH. So you got a guy who's hitting 320 in the big leagues with like 8 or 9 home runs, over 300 plate appearances this year. He's 26 years old. He can really hit, Jeff. But he's getting moved out of the way for a toolsier third baseman who bangs, and for Matt Wallner, who bangs. I don't know. I mean, Minnesota's a pretty analytical organization. You know, there might be something to this, like impact in the bat, size and athleticism, right? Royce Lewis,
yep.
More size and athleticism. Matt Wallner, definitely size, and there's athleticism there.
And there's more ability defensively for both those guys, though I know Wallner's a DH. Like, you can put him into the corner outfield spot if it opens up, and huge arm out there, not a bad runner for a big guy, but it's like a 70-80 arm. I mean, he throws absolute smoke, was a two-way guy in college, so there's some of that there. But yeah, you know, I think that affords players opportunities like power and then just also tools, because either of those guys, even if they're DHing, if there's an opportunity that opens up in the infield or the outfield, Lewis or Wallner is going to take that, especially when Lewis is moving well and feeling healthy. That's the biggest question with him, obviously.
Yeah. So, and Jeff, it kind of comes back to like the whole, like, it's, if you like Kevin McGonigal as a high school prospect, like Kevin McGonigal, you know, but like, that's not my type of player because he's small and he's just an average athlete and he's very skilled. You're just putting a lot more eggs in the, this guy's going to have an 80 hit tool, which it looks like he's going to have to go be a big league regular, but he's never going to have that ceiling that some of these other guys have. Right. It's why, like, I don't dislike Jackson Holliday. Jackson Holliday is a fantastic hitter, but like, I've always liked Jordan Westberg more because Jordan Westberg is the athlete of the two, and Jordan Westberg's providing you real defensive value at three different positions on the dirt. And Jackson Holliday's bat's really good, but he needs to work to be an average second baseman in the big leagues. He's young. He's going to get there, but like, he's not playing shortstop and he's not playing third base. Jordan Westberg can do all three for you and provides you versatility. I read a paper this past week on process flexibility. Doug Fearing, director of research for the Dodgers, I actually, you know, saw it posted by Kyle Bodie. And I was like, oh, this looks interesting because, you know, what's the value of a utility player who can play multiple positions? How does that impact the player? Completely different discussion. Really interesting paper. You know, just trying to get some ideas here in terms of, you know, Brendan Donovan heading towards his first year of arbitration. But anyway, I want to get back on topic. It's why, and if you're a fan of the program, you've heard us talk about guys like Johnny DeLuca and Parker Meadows and Blake Dunn and Justin Dearden, RIP. To his baseball career. He had a really good run for a guy who signed as a 20K guy.
Yeah, as an undrafted free agent after the 2020 draft.
As a 5-year college school player out of SEMO. Like, fantastic run there. Joey Loperfido is another example. It's why I like these types of players, because I know that they've got the high-end speed, and then in most of these cases, they've also got some size. Johnny DeLuca is incredibly strong. Like, I know you can go look up Johnny DeLuca right now and he's not hitting. You can go look up Loperfido right now and he's not hitting. Parker Meadows is starting to hit. Blake Dunn hasn't broken through, but these are the types of guys that it's like, if they get their opportunity and they hit, they're going to provide you a lot of defensive value in the outfield, and they're going to provide you speed on the base paths, and they're going to provide you opportunities to get the power. Now, an example of a player that is in this ilk, Tyler Fitzgerald, not surprising to me. He had elite top speed in college. He was a very discreet fourth round pick out of the University of Louisville during kind of like a golden era for Louisville. Louisville was a really strong program at that time, fourth round shortstop. But it's unsurprising. He had a 9 speed score in college, which translates to a 65. And basically, if you're a 9 or a 10 speed, I mean, that's the top end on the scale. I know it goes to 12, but I don't really see 11s or 12s. It's mostly 9s and 10s. And right now he's in the 99th percentile for speed on Savant. If you don't know who Tyler Fitzgerald is, you live under a rock. He's hitting leadoff for the surging San Francisco Giants. And he's put up absolutely stupid numbers in the past month, right? Like, people want to talk about what Lawrence Butler did in July. He had a fantastic month. You want to talk about what Tyler Fitzgerald has done for the San Francisco Giants in the past month? Yeah, you could write a dissertation on that, right? Tyler Fitzgerald can do that. High-end speed, add strength to that, discrete fourth rounder turns into spark plug. I mean, he's providing five tools. I mean, it's up the middle defense, it's speed, and he's hit like 12 home runs in the past month. He is just on an absolute burner, and that's the whole point of this, is that's why top speed matters. All right, if you're sitting there and you're trying to find the separator between Tyler Fitzgerald and every other college player when he's running home to first, no, you need the top speed. And when you get the top speed, you get an idea of like, okay, this guy's got a chance to have impact tools, and he's showing that. So juxtapose that with guys like Chase Meyerdroff or Cole Young. You know, those are kind of a couple different guys that are in the higher levels of the minor leagues right now, that are hit tool guys. That's kind of where Aiden Miller and Kevin McGonigal are trending in the next couple of years. And I'm not saying they're not going to be big leaguers, but you wonder what else Chase Meyerdroff has to prove in the minor leagues. You think about a guy like Justin Foscue, right, who finally broke through this year with the Rangers, but like he's very
one-dimensional.
Yeah, if you're not a Texas Rangers fan, you don't know who Justin Foscue is at this point. He was a high draft, right? But if you're not a Baltimore Orioles fan, there's a good chance you know who Jordan Westberg is if you follow baseball, because he was an all-star this year. Yeah. Right. So that's the difference. Two Mississippi State infielders. One was selected higher than the other, who was a hit tool guy, and then the other guy provides you defense, elite defense at three positions, and power, and speed. Right. So what did you say?
The tools.
We like toolsy players. That's what we like. That's our philosophy. Me and Jeff, we like toolsy players. We want superstars. We want the guys that are gonna, you know, have their names up in lights. Last thing here in terms of application, and then we'll shut this one down, Jeff. Two players in the same draft. One went a lot higher than the other one, but they both got paid good money. High school players: Colt Emerson, Walker Martin. Okay, Colt Emerson, average size, fringe run. Walker Martin, above average size. He's like 6'2", 6'3". He's going to be over 200 pounds. He is over 200 pounds right now, but he could be like 225, I would bet, on that frame. An elite runner. Okay. Emerson has an elite hit tool. And if he continues to have an elite hit tool, he's going to be a nice big leaguer. He is. Walker is struggling a little bit out of the gate, but he did kind of iron some things out there in the ACL, and then he got promoted to San Jose for the rest of the season. And he is getting to some power, and he's walking, and he's got some strikeout things to iron out. But cold weather player, right? So he didn't have the same USA Baseball pedigree as Colt Emerson, you know, coming up through his amateur career. Applying everything that we've just talked about. Walker, elite size and run. Colt, average size, fringe run. If we're talking about probabilities, and if you're dealing with probabilities, 90% of Walker Martin's ceiling is probably higher at the big league level than 100% of Colt Emerson's ceiling. And if you are going to bet on a player to reach 100% of their ceiling, then you're basically betting on them to be Jackson Holliday. And there aren't a ton of Jackson Holidays out there, right? Because there's a whole lot more guys that have that same profile as Jackson Holliday who don't have 80 hit tools that you just never heard of. There's a lot of those guys out there. And Cole Emerson kind of fits into that bucket where he's roughly the same size, and he's going to need to be an 80 hit tool, 70 hit tool, 80 hit tool. Jeff, how many guys in the big leagues are hitting over 280 right now with
qualified plate appearances. It's really hard to do.
I was going to say it's under 10. It might even be under 5.
Right. It's really, really, really hard to do. That's what Cole Emerson needs to do. Okay. So I just if I'm betting, I would rather bet on a player.
26. It was 26, by the way. It's 26.
That's actually a better number than I thought.
Same.
It's still small. It's microscopic compared to how many players play in the big leagues in any given year. Take names out of it. And Jeff, if you're betting on one, if you're a betting man, you got $5 to put on a horse and one of them only needs to reach 90% of their ceiling. And the other one needs to reach 100% of their ceiling. You're going to put the money on the guy that only needs to reach 90% of the ceiling to be as good or better. Just because there's more wiggle room there. And that's what I'm talking about here with size and athleticism is there's more wiggle room. Because if Walker Martin doesn't have an elite hit tool and he doesn't have an average hit tool and he can have a fringe average hit tool and he can not chase and he can walk a little bit and he can run into some balls, he's got a chance to be like a 220, 230 hitter, defend up the middle and maybe get you 25, 30 home runs, steal some bags. Right? That's valuable.
Yeah.
There's value there. Now, if for some reason he shoots the moon and he gets to 100% of his potential, he's a five-tool player who's going to be a superstar. Cole Emerson doesn't have that kind of ceiling because he's just average size and he's fringe run.
We could probably look at, you know, a guy like Brent Rooker, who's developed into one of the best hitters in baseball, and then go back and look at some of the other college hitters that were in that same draft, guys with higher pedigree, guys with higher hit tools, that maybe performed earlier on in their professional careers that at this point haven't been able to reach, you know, that same ceiling that Rooker has. You know, he's one of the best power hitters in the major leagues right now. And he's hitting 291, 368, 584, despite having a near 30% strikeout rate. And I think that's something that, you know, people have a tough time sometimes adjusting to, because the strikeout rate can scare people away and often can drag down the batting average. But then you go back and, you know, you look at the 2017 draft and guys who had lower strikeout rates and better batting averages that got drafted higher out of college that haven't turned into the same quality of hitter. Pavin Smith being a perfect example. Adam Haseley, Keston Hiura. I mean, there's some guys here, Jake Berger. You know, these are all top 10-ish type picks that some of them have had some success, like Hiura for a very small window, Berger the last couple of years, that just don't even Evan White's another one who got paid. Guys that do not compare to Rooker now and the impact that he's been able to provide over the last couple of years. If he was traded at the deadline, he would have gotten a ransom because he's still got 3 years of control left as well.
Yeah, and if you look at his size, he's 6'3", 225, and he's an average runner. So on that sliding scale, it's like above average to plus size and, you know, average athleticism-ish, right? We don't know what the jump metrics look like. But more or less, that's the kind of guy that I would pay, because I do think at his size, he can continue if as long as the contact quality is there and the decisions are there. He can give you 30-plus home runs into his early to mid 30s. I think he can do that. That's the kind of guy that, you know, if I'm a fantasy baseball nut, like I'm probably trying to get Rooker, because even though he's a little bit older, like I like the way that profile is going to age in terms of longevity. Less maintenance is going to be required. But yeah, I mean, that's just kind of the point. That's the point, Jeff. Size and athleticism, it's important. I mean, look, there are plenty of guys. I just want to touch the contrary here, you know, for the people who say like, oh, well, Billy Hamilton, or like, you can't just go get a track athlete. It's like, yeah, I've already acknowledged guy has to be able to hit enough. Guy also has to have a projectable frame, right? Like Enrique Bradfield's a top end runner, but he has a very lithe frame and he's never going to be 200 pounds. Right. So it's like that guy. You know, he's going to be a speed guy. He's not going to be a power guy, not going to be an impact bat. I think that's kind of obvious at this point. And there's a long line of those guys in the big leagues. There's, you know, the Billy Hamiltons of the world. There's another one in the Tampa organization, Chandler Simpson, right?
Victor Scott.
Right. So it's not just like, oh, this guy's got top end speed. Like, go get him. He's a future superstar. Like, Jaren Duran and Bobby Wood Jr. have like, they're like 200 to 210 pounds of solid muscle on top of being 99th percentile runners.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of guys, Jeff. Those are the kind of guys that you want. Those are the kind of guys that you want to get into your system and take a shot on. So, yes, let's close the book on this, but anybody who's listening to this, thanks for listening for over an hour to the most important thing in my baseball realm.
Well, there you go. It's Matt Pajak dropping a gem on him, like Mobb Deep would say. So thanks for tuning in. It's been another episode of the 90th Percentile. For Jeff, for Matt, have a great week.
Haven't they grown again? But at Matalan, that's no problem because our £5 and under kidswear event has landed. Shop fresh new styles for kids and baby too, all for £5 or less. Shop online at matalan.co.uk and in-store now.
Whether you're starting or scaling your company's security program, demonstrating top-notch security practices and establishing trust is more important than ever. Vanta automates compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more, saving you time and money while helping you build customer trust. Plus, you can streamline security reviews by automating questionnaires and demonstrating your security posture with a customer-facing trust center, all powered by Vanta AI. Over 7,000 global companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. Get $1,000 off Vanta when you go to vanta.com/go. That's vanta.com/go for $1,000 off.